These Days.
Kids These Days.
This is Kids These Days.
Today, we're spending the hour talking about adolescent girls. Last week, we discussed what's special about boys in the same age span. So today, we look at the other half of the teenage population. What pressures do today's girls face that may be different from those of their parents' generation? Where are those pressures coming from? And what can we do to be sensitive to girls' needs and help them become happy, healthy young adults? We've got another installment of our When I Was Young series today, and we report on Alaska's only same-sex classroom. Stay tuned for that and a whole lot more today on Kids These Days. So last week it was teenage boys, and we shine the light today on girls. Are you a teenage girl? What's unique about girlhood today? As always, we want to hear from you. Email us now with your comments. We get those messages at mail@kidsthesedays.org, and you can always comment on our homepage or Facebook page. Joining me today by phone is Dr. Stephen Hinshaw. Dr. Hinshaw is the chair of the psychology department at the University of California, Berkeley. He's also a professor and researcher there. He has a special interest in young people with ADHD, that's attention deficit hyperactive disorder. His ADHD work led him to new discoveries that helped him write The Triple Bind, Saving Our Teenage Girls from Today's Pressures. Hinshaw's interests lie in the fields of clinical child and adolescent psychology and developmental psychopathology. It's with great pleasure that we have Dr. Stephen Hinshaw on the program today to speak with us about our topic, adolescent girls. Thanks so much for being here, Dr. Hinshaw.
I'm delighted to be on.
Well, I'd like to ask you to describe what's in the title of this book I just referred to, The Triple Bind. In your book, you talk about today's world as it relates to adolescent girls, and you come up with this term, the triple bind. Can you just explain it for me?
So let's be kind of brief but complete. If you're a teenage girl today, in some ways things haven't changed much at all, probably by the genes you're born with, the double X chromosome, and by the way you're socialized. You're still the caregiver, the nurturer, you're the empathic one taking care of family members, friends, etc. So that hasn't changed. But then we get the second element today, which makes it a double bind, with Title IX and sports opportunities, with the huge increases in test scores in girls across the last 30 or so years, college admissions, many more girls than boys, young women are graduating from college, going on to professional schools. You've also got to be super competitive and at the top of your class and maybe at the top on the playing field. So how can you be everyone's best friend and empathic while you're charging to the finish line first? That's a bind. Mm-hmm. That's the double bind. But the triple bind, and I think what's new about this analysis in the last few years is, at the same time, it seems as though girls have alternative role models and can be competitive and nurturant and do this pretty easily, there's still this socialization pressure that's building that you've got to do so while you're looking pretty hot. And the alternative role models out there, rock singers, athletes, often the pressure is you can't just be competent, you've also got to be really good looking and be aware of your body at the same time. So that's the triple bind. How can you be relentlessly nurturing and relentlessly competitive and be aware of your body image and ideal at the same time? It's physically and psychologically impossible to do all three things at once. And I think this is a key reason behind the very depressing mental health statistics that have been emerging in the last 5 to 10 years. We know that the teenage years are a period of risk for girls in general, but that risk is growing before our eyes, and the statistics are pretty scary.
Well, Dr. Hinshaw, I'd love for you to share some of those statistics. I know as I was reading your book, one that jumped out at me, as I'm sure it did to you, was 15 to 20% of U.S. girls ages 10 to 19 meet criteria for what's considered to be major depression. Seems like such a huge number. Can you explain that?
So we know that around the world, before you're 10 or 11, boys are actually somewhat more likely than girls to develop major depression, not just being sad or demoralized, but sleep disturbance and real hopeless thinking and thoughts of suicide crowding your mind right at or around the time of puberty. Girls skyrocket past boys, and in every culture we know, women have a 2 to 2.5 times greater rate of major depression than men. But what we're finding is that when I was in grad school, for example, some decades ago, we learned that the average age at which a woman had her first depression was in her mid-30s. Today, that age has dropped to the early to mid-20s, and many women are getting depressed before they're women, when they're 13, 14, 15, and 16. So before our eyes, genes haven't changed. Our underlying biology hasn't changed across the last 30 years, the last 5 or 10 years in particular. But there must be something in the culture out there that's driving girls and women to express whatever vulnerability they might have toward depression. It's coming out earlier and earlier, and I believe that the culture is playing a big part of this.
Now, that's a huge difference to have kids who are still kids, they're teenagers and early adults, having their first depressive episode versus, you know, as you said, when you were in grad school, women having that first depressive episode if they're to have one in their 30s. I mean, the teenage brain is still developing during its teenage years. This seems like a major shift.
It's a major shift, and we can't explain it all by biology. I mean, we know that there's some genetic risk to getting major depression. There's a higher genetic risk for getting bipolar disorder, where you have manias and depressions, a higher genetic risk for schizophrenia. But there's some risk in the genes for depression. But our genes don't change across one or two generations. It would take many generations for mutations to build. It must be something out there in the world that's what we might call pushing the genetic envelope, fueling an ever earlier onset of, again, not just sad mood, but real depression. And now, we can't do a randomized trial around the world and assign girls to the conditions of the triple bind. We can't make them feel sexualized or make them feel competitive, but the evidence is pretty compelling that across the last decade, the increase in competitiveness and that pressure and the increase in the need to do everything relentlessly perfectly all the time and be quite aware, if you're a girl, of how your body looks while you're doing it is certainly correlated with this spike in depression. The biggest increase in the United States across the last few years, and not attempted, but actual suicide, has been in girls 10 to 14, a 76% increase a few years ago.
Wow, and that
boys are not showing that kind of rate of increase. Something's going on that's making the teenage years, which have been risky for girls for time immemorial, ever more risky.
And you write in your book also that 1 in 10 young women, teenage girls, report having seriously contemplated suicide. Is that an accurate portrayal of the statistic?
It is an actual accurate rate. In our own study that we're writing up for publication now, based on our sample of girls with ADHD, the largest such sample in the world, and of course if you have ADHD, you're not focusing well, you're impulsive, you have risk factors building early. And we have a built-in comparison group of girls without ADHD, normal, healthy, functioning girls. In our comparison group, our control group, 6% of girls between the ages of roughly 10 and 20 didn't just contemplate, made a suicide attempt. But the rate in our ADHD group was almost 20%.
Wow.
So if you've got early risks, if you've been traumatized or abused, or if you've got the kind of mental health condition that makes you stand out like a sore thumb in the classroom, the usual risks and problems of the teenage years, which are getting ever more stressful all the time, are compounded by that vulnerability, and we're seeing rates of not just suicidal ideation or contemplation, but actual attempt that are utterly depressing.
And Dr. Henshaw, you also write about rises in other kinds of expressions of this anxiety and of these difficulties that you describe as being part of the triple bind. And these are also self-destructive behaviors, like eating behaviors and cutting. You also talk about a rise in violence perpetrated by young women, by teen girls. Can you tell us a little bit more about those things that you're observing?
That anorexia nervosa and bulimia nervosa, the very serious eating disorders, affect girls much more than boys. We don't see much evidence that those rates have gone up appreciably in the last 10 or 20 years. What's gone up is a less overtly severe but still problematic thing called binge eating disorder, where you may not have the weight loss in anorexia and bulimia, but you're dealing with the ravages of adolescence and your body image by overeating, stuffing yourself, purging in ways that are harmful. You mentioned cutting, which I talked about in the triple bind. Cutting is only one form of, the sort of fancy term is, NSSI, non-suicidal self-injurious behavior. Now, it's an interesting concept. Maybe some kids are so demoralized that they want to end their lives, but a larger number are doing things to express a deep pain that they can't otherwise express, burning themselves, carving with a knife into their skin and seeing the blood ooze, or banging their head into a radiator. The idea is that kids that are doing this don't necessarily want to die, but they've got this deep psychological pain, and the only way to really experience it, because they have no words for it, is to inflict harm upon themselves. Now, the catch is that non-suicidal self-injurious behavior like cutting is often a precursor to actual suicide attempts. So they're not as distinct as we might think. But we don't really know how much of this occurred 30 years ago because there was no published studies on it. We know now that it seems to be epidemic. You can go from all the way from pulling at your cuticles, very, very mild self-injurious behaviors, all the way to very serious ones. Young people are doing this a lot. Some of it's contagion. It's a sort of acceptable way in some quarters to express pain. But teen girls are at higher risk than boys, and those rates are growing. And then finally, everything we've talked about, depression, suicide, cutting, binge eating, they're what are considered the internalizing problems. You're kind of taking whatever conflict or pain and acting it out against yourself, if you will. But what about violence and aggression and hitting and fighting, externalizing behavior? That's gone down in the United States in boys since 1995, but it's gone up 35% in girls. So girls aren't just taking out pressures and conflicts against themselves, they're using violence against others more too. So the triple bind has consequences that are far-ranging.
I'd like to remind listeners that this is Kids These Days, where the conversation today is about adolescent girls. I'm Shanna Sheehy, and I'm speaking with Dr. Stephen Henshaw, chair of the psychology department at UC Berkeley and author of The Triple Bind, Saving Our Teenage Girls from Today's Pressures. And Dr. Henshaw, you know, before you were describing some of these behaviors that in your research you're finding are more prevalent than maybe people believed previously, and also it seems like these are epidemic and on the rise, and you alluded to there being reasons for this or causes for this that are, you know, deeper than someone's specific family circumstances, say, or, you know, something that happened in school. What have you learned, or what do you believe are the causes, the reasons behind why these changes are happening within our young women today?
Well, this is sort of the $64 trillion question, and as with all mental health problems, there's not one single or simple cause. We talked a few minutes ago that genes and biology have something to do with this. All adolescents take more risks than they did just a couple of years ago when they were still kids. Adolescence is, in many ways, the healthiest time of our life. We're at our peak physical and cognitive powers. But at the same time, adolescents, with the changes in puberty and the pressures that we've been talking about, predict high rates of accidents, high rates of mental health problems, especially in girls. So biology and culture both play a role there. But in terms of kids who are at risk for the most serious problems that we're talking about, the kind of genes you're born with play a role. It's not like we thought in the 1950s that parenting is everything. Parents react to the different temperaments and styles of their kids, and there are some families in which there's clusters of depression and suicide and other mental health problems. But it can't be all biology and genes, because how could we see these sharp increases in these very dangerous behaviors, especially in teenage girls, within a generation? If it were genes driving this, there couldn't be those phenomenal rates of mutation and the genetic sort of penetrance into the next generation that quickly. It would take hundreds of years. There must be something, these pressures that are pulling the trigger, so to speak. And let me just speak a minute to some of these pressures. In the focus groups we did for the Triple Bind, what did we hear from teen girls over and over? Not so much scheduling. Yeah, some kids are overscheduled, but having a lot of activities is probably protective against drug abuse. It's probably helpful for your self-esteem. But it's the pressure to be perfect in all ways, all the time. At UC Berkeley, where I teach, what was the admission rate last year? The record low. The median grade point average for an entering freshman was about a 4.2. Not only all A's, but A's in your AP courses. That's the median.
Wow.
Harvard admitted 6% of students last year. Berkeley about 7 or 8. More and more applying for fewer and fewer slots. The pressure's relentless. And then how do you do all this and all your extracurriculars? Well, you sacrifice sleep. National Sleep Survey shows that the average teenage kid is getting around 6 hours of sleep a night, and they need 9 to 9.5. What happens if you're sleep deprived? You remember everything negative that happened during the day and hardly anything positive. So sleep plays a role. Pressure plays a role. And the media and the relentless sexualization and sexual objectification, which really inflicts wounds more upon girls than boys. How do you do all this and look perfect? How do you do all this and not let anybody see that you're sweating? It's physically impossible. It's psychologically impossible. And the qualitative sense we got in preparing for this book was girls are taking it out against themselves. There must be something wrong with me if I can't be a great athlete and a great student and look hot relentlessly all the time and don't let anybody know that I'm feeling any pressure. How can you be encountering pressure but not showing it's going on? You're going to probably internalize there's something wrong with me. Now, this isn't the full explanation. There's other parts of adolescence. There may be subcultures in our nation and world that help protect some girls. We know that African-American girls are at less risk for eating disturbance than white girls because the culture doesn't have such an ideal of thinness. But you've got to think that the way the culture's been heading, it's putting way too many girls, and boys are another story. They've got their mental health problems too, but girls' spikes in these problems are going up right before our eyes.
You write in your book that there's this interesting thing happening where there are all these pressures. As you mentioned in the Triple Bind, I'll remind listeners that, you know, the first part of the bind is that girls have to be good at all the girl stuff. And the second part is that girls have to be good at all the boys stuff.
They've got to be just as competitive as the boys now. That's right.
And then the third part is that girls are expected to conform to these narrow, unrealistic standards, and there's no alternative to that offered to them that they can see. So this is happening to our girls, according to your research and your observations. And then it also is one of the best times in the history to be a woman. There are so many opportunities. It's something that's common to see women at the table when there are important policy decisions being made. We had a woman who almost became the Democratic nominee for the presidential election the last time around. This is such an interesting paradox to me, that there are these pressures that are getting girls down before they even become women, while at the same time there's this idea and this truth that women can achieve so much.
Yeah, what did Dickens say? It's the best of times and the worst of times. it's hard to argue against the fact that no time in history has ever been like this for opportunities for girls and women. And you mentioned some of the opportunities, and I mentioned before that I think now we've gone over 60% of bachelor's degrees in America go to women, 62% of master's degrees. Law school and med school admissions are exactly at parity, 50-50. This was unheard of a generation or two ago. My mother wanted to be a doctor and was told by her family, girls don't go to medical school. Girls under Title IX get the same access to sports, and schools have to ante up for sports equitably across the sexes. Again, how many girls in my high school class back in Ohio got athletic scholarships? A flat zero. And now this is a big opportunity for many girls. So how can you argue against it? And I'm certainly not arguing against equal rights and going back to the bad old days of 50 years ago. But it's the more subtle pressures to be relentlessly perfect, to not let anybody see that you've got flaws, that to get that 4.2 and you're still 50-50 chance of getting admitted and be president of all the clubs and be top of your sports game and look the way you think you have to look by reading the media and seeing the ads. How can you do all that and get any sleep? How can you do all that without, in some ways, and this gets more psychological, developing what some people call a false self? The relentlessness of the pressure was the theme that really drove the writing of The Triple Bind. And one of the big questions is, how can we help girls attain the competence that they should, but help to remove some of this pressure that is driving too many of them into self-destructive behavior?
Well, you're listening to Kids These Days on this listener-supported station. This program is made possible through a partnership between KSKA-FM Anchorage and the Content Producers Guild, an independent media organization. We at Kids These Days like to hear from as many listeners as possible each week. So for this show, we've gone out to ask women about something that happens to each of them during early adolescence. Last week, we discussed how our culture lacks a sanctioned rite of passage for boys, but that it's different for girls because their bodies tell them when they transition from girlhood to womanhood. For this installment of When I Was Young, KTD producer Sarah Gonzalez asked women about getting their periods for the first time.
I think my mom, she really prepared me for the time that I would have my first period. She was really helpful. She gave me all the books and gave me, you know, her thoughts and ideas about it. It was never really a taboo subject in my family, but, you know, when the time did come, I did have my reservations. I wasn't 100% ready to tell my mother, you know, so at some points I did go at it alone. I was a little bit older when I had my first period. So it was just a little more nerve-wracking, I think. So
when you got your period the first time, did you feel any differently afterwards?
I guess just nervous, like everyone knew and they were looking at me. I didn't feel like more womanly until later when I really truly understood, you know, what it meant. I think certain things like that just come with more age and more time and experience.
It was the day that I was supposed to go swimming with my best friend, Anna, at the same time, on that day. And I remember being extremely disappointed because we couldn't go to the pool and being embarrassed because I couldn't tell her why I couldn't go swimming, but it was a big deal at the time, you know, being 12 years old. And so not being able to talk about it with my friends who hadn't gotten their period yet, or not necessarily talking about it with my mother and sort of just being handed a pad and saying, okay, this is your life now, but not having a very in-depth conversation about it with family or friends. And I don't know that many of my friends did have those conversations with their families, with their mothers in particular, or sisters. Certainly the people that I grew up with in my neighborhood, it was always a very taboo subject. You know, and compared to other cultures, for example, in Nepal, where I did research on gender issues, and it's a more ritualized aspect of a young girl's experience.
Tell me about your memories of your first period.
I had no idea what it was all going to be like. You know, I knew this was going to happen, but I had no idea. My mom didn't tell me anything about it. And my friend Amy and I were actually at the district basketball tournament in Sydney, which was a big deal. We were in the bathroom at the tournament, and I told my friend Amy, oh, my God, you know. And she's like, oh, my mom didn't tell me anything. Here, my sister told me about tampons. They're the greatest thing ever. You have to use a tampon. Don't use pads. Use these tampons. Anyway, if it wasn't for my friend Amy, I wouldn't have had a clue.
Did you tell your mom about it afterwards?
No, but I told her I needed tampons.
How old were you when you got your first period, and what do you remember about it?
Well, I was 11 years old. And we were coming home from a football game, and my brother and sister were still at the high school with my mom, turning in their band uniforms and whatnot, and I was coming home with my dad. And my dad turned to me and said, so, your mom has told me that you had your period. And the only thing that I could think of was, how fast can I get out of the close confines of this car with my dad, because this is not something that I want to be talking to him about.
What do you remember about your first period?
Fifth grade, we were sitting down reading stories in front of the teacher, sitting Indian style, and the boy I liked pointed it out to me.
Those voices were collected by our producer, Sarah Gonzalez. I am Shanna Sheehy. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in the second half of the show with guest Dr. Stephen Henshaw. We'll continue our conversation about adolescent girls. Also still to come this hour, KTD's Jessica Cochran reports on Alaska's only same-sex public school classroom. And we'll dust off a few minutes of an archived program to remind you about an opportunity to enroll your child in a special camp for Alaska teens. Stay with us. Next time on Kids These Days, we're learning about special education. Across Alaska, school districts and private organizations assist families with children who have special needs. What resources are available where you live? And how best can our communities support kids who face challenges? Also this hour, we'll learn about one family whose disabled child is off on her own at college for the first time this year. And we'll find out about what's available where for preschool and daycare. The topic is special education next time on Kids These Days. We're back. You're tuned into Kids These Days. I'm Shanna Sheehy. Thanks for joining me today. I'm speaking with Dr. Stephen Henshaw today about the modern adolescent girl. Dr. Henshaw is the chair of the UC Berkeley Psychology Department and the author of The Triple Bind, Saving Our Teenage Girls from Today's Pressures. He and I will get back to our interview here soon, but first this. This week and last week on Kids These Days, we've been talking about adolescent boys and girls both. What sorts of challenges do they face these days? How may teenagerhood have changed since today's parents were themselves teenagers? And how different are boys and girls, really? Last week's guest, Michael Gurian, believes there are fundamental biological and neurological differences that affect how boys and girls behave, what they need as they develop, and how they learn in school. That view is shared by many people who argue in favor of same-sex schools or classes, not just in private schools, but in public schools as well. But not everyone agrees with the premise that girls and boys learn differently or need different ways of teaching. For this week, Kids These Days contributor Jessica Cochran looked at the controversy surrounding single-sex public schools.
In 2006, the U.S. Department of Education wrote new regulations paving the way for single-sex public schooling. And since then, more than 500 public schools in the United States have implemented single-sex schools or single-sex classes within a co-ed school. The National Association for Single-Sex Public Education lists them on its website. For Alaska, just one pops up, Gilson Junior High in Valdez. Principal Rod Morrison implemented single-sex classes for some 7th and 8th graders back in 2006 after what he called a data retreat. When they looked at their school's test scores in detail, they noticed the boys were 20 points behind the girls on average.
We just were trying to come up with a way. We thought, shoot, if we could help these boys out, then the overall score is going to come up quite a bit. And the other thing we experienced was a lot of discipline issues in the school. It seemed like every day I was seeing a dozen kids, and maybe all of them were always boys. And so we just started putting these pieces together, and we actually found a school in Colorado that had tried some single-sex courses and had some really good success with it. So we decided that if we didn't change anything we were doing, then we were going to be failing some kids, and we weren't okay with that. One of our mottos is success is the only option. And so we were willing to step outside of the normal box to try something to help, and we talked about the time, if this doesn't work, we'll go back to drawing board and find something else.
At Gilson, single-sex classes are only offered if there are enough students and teachers for three sections of a class, a boys class, a girls class, and a co-ed class, so that participation is always optional. In seventh grade, the reading, language arts, and social studies block class is available as a single-sex class. In eighth grade, science and reading.
I've been asked to make a math class that way, and I just don't have enough sections to be offer three of each to do that.
Morrison, who was named Alaska's Middle School Principal of the Year in 2010, says it's successful. As soon as it was implemented, he saw boys and girls' scores go up. Where typically in middle school, student test scores go down, in Valdez, that's when they are highest. And he doesn't think it's because it's new and different. After all, it's been 5 years now. He says the curriculum is the same in each class, but teachers are trained to present the material and structure the classes in ways that make them more accessible to girls or boys.
Sometimes it's different books, but it's the same curriculum delivered. Like, for example, reading books, the girls' classes tend to be more feminine books, and the boys being more masculine books, just to kind of hold their interest. But all the curriculum, the writing, the, you know, even the reading standards are all the same across the board. It's just kind of the delivery way. And the example, let this bell ring here for a second. The example I'll give is in the boys' class, our boys' teacher will sometimes talk about sentence structure. And when he talks about sentence structure, he pulls out a bolt. And he says, you know, okay, here's your sentence, and we're going to throw a couple adjectives in, and he puts a couple washers on the bolt. And now we're going to put a nut on the end, which is going to, you know, conclude the sentence. So it's just kind of the It's just kind of the way the delivery is, where boys are more visual, hands-on, in a lot of cases, not always, but in a lot of cases, they get that.
And that's just what bothers opponents of single-sex education. They worry those lessons, those different strategies, are based on stereotypes of boys and girls that just aren't true. Rosalind Barnett is a senior researcher at Brandeis University's Women's Studies Research Center and co-author with Carol Rivers of the upcoming book, The Truth About Girls and Boys. She recalls talking with a researcher about the notion, widely believed, that boys learn better in a more physically active setting.
I interviewed an important kinesthesiologist who studies cognitive abilities, and I asked him specifically, do you find gender differences? In fact, are boys better, do they learn better when they're exposed to great gross motor activity? He said he's looked over and over in his data, and these are peer-reviewed studies, and he's never found an effect for gender. So boys and girls do better when there's some activity when they're learning. And this is hugely important, because most people, when they hear these statements, they sound rational. They sound, oh yeah, that makes sense. And boys are active, and so that would be enhanced learning when they have an opportunity to be active. But the stereotype says girls are passive. They're not like that. So often people don't ask the question, well, wait a minute. You know, couldn't it be that girls also learn in an active, physically active environment? And when you ask the question, indeed it turns out that girls do learn better that way. But if you start segregating kids by sex and you assume that girls are not going to learn that way, you don't create an environment for girls to express themselves in that domain.
Barnett thinks we're overly concerned with pointing out the differences between girls and boys, when really they have far more in common.
Basically, girls and boys are very similar beings. They're curious, they're active, they're kind, and then later on they're more similar than different in other ways. But we lose this focus on similarity in this sort of searching around for little differences that we then blow up and say, oh my God, you know, boys are like this and girls are like that.
Other factors play a much larger role than gender in how kids do in school, race, socioeconomic class. To some extent, she sees it as a resource issue. With declining school budgets, should districts really be putting money into an idea that isn't shown to make any clear difference in learning outcomes? Peer-reviewed scientific studies of gender segregation in education have been inconclusive, whereas newer computers, more books, and better teacher training and pay have been shown to work. Elena Silva, a senior education policy analyst with the nonpartisan think tank Education Sector, shares that concern. Without clear scientific evidence about what works in single-sex classes, there are no guidelines for districts or schools to work by, so they're making those decisions individually.
The quality of learning could really be affected and could be negatively impacted if you start to design things around what you think boys respond to and what you think girls respond to.
Silva agrees there is a desperate need to find something that works in education and understands the inclination to try anything that seems like it's working. But she sees a difference between anecdotal evidence that separating boys and girls is working and scientific peer-reviewed studies that control for other differences among the students, teachers, and classes that could be contributing to their success. She's not sure why there's so much focus on gender over other factors, and she sees potential harm in single-sex schools.
You can also very easily reinforce a lot of the stereotypes that we see every day, a lot of the stereotypes that that I think have in the past historically left girls or directed girls in a certain direction or directed boys in a certain direction that's given them a message about what it means to be a girl or what it means to be a boy.
But some proponents of single-sex schooling argue just the opposite. They say single-sex schooling is a better place to break down stereotypes, that it gives boys a safe place to like poetry, for instance, or girls a safe place to become computer nerds. Providence College researcher Dr. Cornelius Reardon has studied single-sex education extensively. He believes it can only work when the whole school is single-sex. He says that allows the school to develop a culture where academics are valued. Dr. Leonard Sachs is founder and director of NASPE, the group that advocates for single-sex public education. He says given the sex stereotypes that exist in our culture, given that popular culture teaches boys being a rapper with a history of jail time is better than being smart, and teaches girls their physical image is more important than their brains, single-sex schooling may be the only way to break them out of those stereotypes. He advocates for single-sex schooling only if teachers are trained in how to do it well, so that it's addressing the different needs without perpetuating stereotypes. Principal Rod Morrison says they did a lot of teacher and parent education at Gilson Junior High before starting same-sex classes. Now, he says, many students like it.
Boys will say they'll try new things in front of other boys. They wouldn't try in front of girls. I can remember a boy one time, he said, you know, I won't read out loud in front of girls because I'm not very good at it, but these guys are just like me. And so kids were willing to take more chances than they were in a class with the opposite gender.
And a little friendly competition between the boys and girls classes in a geography bee, for instance, sends students to the library to study at lunchtime, something he rarely saw before. I'm Jessica Cochran.
Okay, Dr. Hinshaw. Would you like to respond to that same-sex school question, first off?
When I speak about the triple bind to parents, to teachers, to high school kids, to almost anyone, to scientists and researchers, maybe the most common question I get is, but wouldn't it, Dr. Hinshaw, really help if gals could be together in their own classrooms, their own schools, and guys could be together? Then we don't have guys who see the same media messages about girls' body images, start hassling, pestering, even harassing them ever earlier ages. Wouldn't girls be best to not have to live up to male expectations and have their own culture and climate? This begs the question of whether girls have an independent, unique learning style, which I'm not so sure about at all. And the sad answer is we just don't know. No one is able to take a bunch of high school kids and randomly assign some of them to same-sex classrooms and some to co-ed classrooms or schools. We end up, for the most part, with at the private school level, some families selecting their kids to go to same-sex, so we don't know if it's the actual classrooms or it's the family composition and values that predict what the outcomes are. I think there could be some advantages, for sure, but I also would hope, maybe this is the idealist in me speaking up, that if we can do some of the things I hope we talk about to change some of these cultural expectations, boys and girls are going to be together as men and women the rest of their lives, in relationships, in the marketplace, in neighborhoods. And if they both could get on board with the right kinds of messages early on, the separation may not be necessary. So those are a few of my non-scientific thoughts about this most provocative topic.
Well, Dr. Hinshaw, I do want to ask you more about media and how media plays into how it is that adolescent girls, you know, perceive themselves and how it contributes to the culture in which our young girls are growing up. In your book, you reference a couple of different television programs that I think they make great examples of some of these things that you talk about in terms of how girls are supposed to be and how impossible some of these expectations can be. For example, you talk about America's Next Top Model quite a bit, and how the show, you know, some of our listeners will have seen it and some won't, but that in it, these girls who are competitors are supposed to be nurturing and competitive. They're supposed to be beautiful in a way that's exactly the same, yet also be unique in some way that's told to them.
Did you mention the word paradox before? That's
yes.
Exactly right.
And Dr. Hinshaw, my business is media, and I've learned that it's very difficult to really prove that there's any link between what people see in Grey's Anatomy or America's Next Top Model or soap operas or movies and how people behave. Do you have an answer to that?
Well, this is a huge topic. I had to read in communication studies, as well as my more traditional clinical and developmental psychology, in preparing for the triple bind, and it's a big contentious issue. Does the media shape us, or do we, as a culture, shape what's on the media, and what's chicken and what's egg? And it's a hugely viable point. A couple of responses. There wouldn't be the advertising budgets in the multi-billions and tens of billions of dollars that we have unless somebody out there with a lot of money thought that media doesn't shape people's attitudes and beliefs and behaviors. So that's number one. Number two, the idea is that it's very hard to do the kind of controlled study you'd like. What are we going to do? Randomly assign half of the population in Alaska, in California, in New York, wherever, to watch media for a year, and the other half are not allowed to turn on their computers or watch television or read a magazine. It's practically impossible to do. But there is a sense that media both reflect the culture, but the relentlessness of media images at a very unconscious level shape expectations and perceptions. If some people are very extreme media bashers, and in some ways you have to take them at their word. If media were as pervasive as some people claimed, every single girl and young woman and middle-aged woman in America would have an eating disorder, which is certainly not the case. There's resilience and health. A lot of people can resist some of the more pernicious elements of the message. What we need to know is who's the most vulnerable. Different but related topic, do violent video games and violent television promote aggression in kids? And this is a huge topic, and the journal I edit called Psychological Bulletin, we published a big paper last year on this very topic, and the evidence is pretty clear. Number one, more aggressive, violent kids are drawn to those media. But number two, even controlling, taking into account what we call that selection bias or factor, controlling, making everything kind of equal, even if you're drawn to it, a lot of exposure makes you both immediately and longer term even more likely to be violent. So it's not all media, it's not all genes, it's not all families. It's these fascinating combinations of vulnerabilities and strengths and cultural exposure that predict the huge array of outcomes we see.
And Dr. Hinshaw, you write about how images of women in the media are portrayed as being overly sexualized and overly feminized. And I wanted to ask you about that, and I also wanted to make sure that we got a chance to talk about what you also call a lack of alternatives and how that's changed since I myself was a teenage girl.
Right. So let's see, where should we start first? Let's start with the last first because it's most on my mind. I mean, people say in response to me if I talk or have read the triple bind, wait a minute, this is 2011 now, and there's a lot of different identities available in our culture. It's not the 50s. It's not Ozzie and Harriet, right? We're very variegated world out there. And one of the responses is, yes, I can, as a teenage girl or boy, but we'll focus on girls, say I don't just have to be a straight-A student or an athlete. I could, we talked about this before, I could become a rock singer, or I could become an athlete, which I wasn't available to me in my mother's generation. But if you look hard at who the successful rock singers and athletes and sort of cultural icons are today, they're not just great at what they do, but for girls and women, they're great at what they do and have a very sexualized look that they have to have too. Liz Phair, the rock singer, the Williams sisters and Maria Sharapova on the tennis court. Again, not enough just to be a great athlete, but you got to look a certain way while you do it. My fear is, given what we just said, the media isn't all-powerful, but some of the media images we have out there now and some of the lack of true alternatives, and many of the alternatives have been co-opted. You got to look really good and be really talented. So it's not enough as a girl to just be super competent. There's this triple bind pressure of looking and acting a certain way at the same time. That's the big concern.
And you write that whereas in previous generations there might have been these alternate paths as well, like say being in, you know, a goth or you know,
beatnik.
A hippie,
right.
Those kinds of things, that even those images have been co-opted into showing images of the hippie chick who's also hot.
That's right. That's the problem, I think.
Well, this is Kids These Days, and today we're taking a look at the lives of teenage girls in our culture. I'm Shanna Sheehy, and I'm talking about that with Dr. Stephen Henshaw this hour. And Dr. Henshaw, in the time we have left, you mentioned it before, you alluded to it before, I do want to talk about, you know, the bright side of this. You write about how resiliency is so important when it comes to trying to help our teenage girls navigate this difficult terrain. Will you please explain that?
So resilience is a term that has a lot of meanings today, and it's in a lot of websites and a lot of psychological studies. The general meaning is, I've got risks. I'm vulnerable. The genes I was born with, traumatic experiences I had, the family I grew up with had troubles, the cultural expectations we're talking about right now on this program. But there's a certain percentage of people who really defy those odds and come out with real strength and really come out having defied the odds, if you will. What are the factors that might promote health, resilience, strength in teenage girls and anybody in our culture right now? And listed a few in the triple bind. Number one is we've got to encourage kids to talk about these pressures and issues. What is one of the key features of this very terrible thing we talked about before the break called cutting, self-harm, self-injurious behavior? I feel a deep pain. I feel awful about myself, my family, the world in general. I don't have any words for it, but if I see the blood oozing, or if I feel my head ringing from bashing it against a wall, or feel the burn mark, awful as these images are, I've expressed the pain. What if we could put words to it? I talk to a lot of parents' groups, and the parents will say, but you remember, of course I have three boys, so why am I writing about teenage girls, but you remember that time with your older boys when they would rather probably be dead than caught with you out in public. Drop me two blocks from the movie theater, get away from the car, right? But at the same time, the kids are desperately wanting you to stay connected with them at the dinner table, talking about events at school. Obviously, the teenage years are kind of private in some ways, but stay engaged. If we can help kids put words on the feelings and pressures, maybe they won't have to resort to some of these other terribly self-destructive acts. How do we fuel and foster the natural empathy that girls and boys have? Well, one way not to do it is to insist for every college application that you have 15 extracurriculars and you've been president of four clubs. What about doing one thing really well? What about if in schools, now I'm going to sort of flip over into educational policy, we allowed more courses pass-fail? So you could explore, again, if the goal of adolescence is to form an identity, mm-hmm. what do you do well, what do you not do so well, and to take appropriate risks, what if you've got to be perfect in every subject all the time, and then you will never go to college and your life is ruined? If we could foster that intrinsic motivation, that creativity, that empathy, without the relentless pressure to be perfect in every way, we might see a more natural and more empathic next generation grow up. If we could get kids to be attuned and have opportunities to do so to the very real problems in our communities, in our society, around the world, you look at the news every day, there's relentlessly difficult situations at hand. If you're not gazing into that mirror of how well you're doing and how you look while you're doing it, but could get attuned to helping to solve the real problems we have, that in some ways may be the total antidote to the triple bind and the best promoter of resilience. Now, these are big issues. We're not going to solve them tomorrow, but it's going to take families, it's going to take educators, social policy people, we adults in the culture, to help create settings in which kids don't have to prove that they're perfect and always every second, or they're doomed. Those are the messages we've got to eliminate.
And you, in your book, you also compare two young women who have a, sort of an equal tendency toward mood disorder in their genes.
Right.
And you compare and contrast how one responds to challenge in her life and how the other does. And the one that I want to point out here and maybe have you talk more about is the child who, because her family is involved in a church, is involved with other civic groups through both of her parents' organizations, because there are additional spheres in which this one child goes into on a regular basis besides just the family and besides just her school, she's able to get through this challenge in a way that is more what we hope for all children, where she gets sad and has a hard time, but she doesn't fall into depression.
Boy, the term you sort of plucked from this, the different spheres, I think is crucial. The pathway to self-destruction, to be somewhat dramatic about it, but appropriately so, is there only one way I can be academically, only one way I can look, only one way out of this morass of childhood and adolescence? Boy, that one way or the highway is a pretty narrow path. Are there social supports in a community group, in a church, in an extended family? Are there a couple of different ways you can feel good about yourself? Another part of this that I didn't mention before is, how could we foster better critical thinking among all of our teens, not just girls, but boys, and starting before the teen years? What's an advertisement? What's a news story? Do I believe everything I see in the media? Do I believe everything I hear from family members and teachers? And critical thinking, different organizations and levels of support, different kinds of avenues in which to show strength. We're a pluralistic, multifaceted society, and if we can allow kids to see that there's multiple ways to survive adolescence and find ways to thrive rather than this sort of perfection or bust, I think these are the things that will really help us in the long run.
Well, Dr. Henshaw, I want to thank you so much for your time today. It's truly been a pleasure to have you on Kids These Days.
Well, I hope that listeners have got something out of these big picture issues we've talked about, and the stakes are high. It's the next generation. It's the future of our society.
Dr. Stephen Henshaw is the author of The Triple Bind, Saving Our Teenage Girls from Today's Pressures. He's a professor and researcher at University of California, Berkeley, where he also serves as the chair of the psychology department. He's also an expert on attention deficit hyperactive disorder and has written extensively on adolescent mental health and other topics. You can find out more about him and link to his work through our website. Come on over to kidsthesedays.org and you'll find all of that and more. Kids These Days recently celebrated our one-year anniversary on the air in South Central Alaska.
Today, we're reaching back into our archive to revisit an important topic for many young people and families. In 2010, Kids These Days had a conversation about bereavement, specifically about how adults can help the children in their lives who may be grieving the death of a loved one. I was joined in the studio by Jane Barber of Hospice of Anchorage and Shirley Valick-Wilson, an advanced nurse practitioner who works with kids who take part in the Forget Me Not program offered by Hospice of Anchorage. Here's a little bit of that conversation.
We have infants, littles, kiddles, middles, young teens, and older teens. So when the children arrive, they're going to be put with boys and girls in their own developmental age group. So that would be infants. We usually have infants together with 3 to 5 year olds, and the next group is 6 to 8, and so on. So across a couple 2-3 year age group, they'll meet with boys and girls.
And so when they get together in these age groups where they're with people who are the same age as them, what kind of process is that for them? How is it different from just being in the schoolyard, for example?
Well, I think that's the beauty of the program, particularly in grief. It can be very isolating for everyone, children and adults. You can feel not normal. You know, you're going through this experience where time has stands still and the rest of life is still moving around you. And children don't like to be different. Sometimes they get singled out, or for many, they don't have anyone they can confide in, even a friend at school. It's awkward. So when they get into a grief situation, when they've lost someone, a special someone in their lives, they can come to Forget Me Not for as long as they want to. It's an open program, and we see it. I mean, it isn't even something they say, but you can see that as they come to their groups, here are kids in a like situation who get it. They're working with the thoughts and feelings and experiences that they are. So right, there's a bond, or there's a normalizing that happens for their process because they're with others who are doing the same thing.
Is there like a safety to that versus when they're out with, you know, a general population and there's kids who maybe haven't experienced that and they just don't understand what that kid might be feeling?
I think so. I think you've described it really well. I think the safety comes in the experiential knowing of what this feels like. Grief touches us on all levels. Children too, you know, it's the physical, emotional, spiritual, mental, every aspect of who we are is touched by this experience. Although I should say for kids, cognitively, we don't really fully grow our brains till I think the early 20s. Shirley, is that right, Shirley?
That's right, yep.
Yeah. And so the little ones, it tends to be in their bodies, and many times they'll process and they'll experience it through play or role playing. But yeah, they get with their same age group and they're with others who are working it through just like them. And so there's like a bond or camaraderie to that.
You can listen to this full program from our archive by going to kidsthesedays.org. Hospice of Anchorage offers an annual grief camp for children and teenagers, ages 6 to 17. Camp Erin is what it's called, and it's for kids who have experienced the death of someone close to them. The deadline to register for Camp Erin is coming up at the end of this week. You can find out more about it on their website, hospiceofanchorage.org, and we'll link you from ours as well. You can email fmn@hospiceofanchorage.org or call 907-561-5322 for more information. We'll have that email address and the number for you at kidsthesedays.org as well. That's all for this hour of Kids These Days. Thanks again to today's guest, Dr. Stephen Hinshaw. Kids These Days is produced by Sarah Gonzalez, who also manages our business and our electronic media. Jessica Cochran reported today from Anchorage and is our technical editor and assistant producer. Our theme music and other original songs are written, performed, and produced by Lost Lander. I'm Shanna Sheehy, your host today. Come back and join us next week for another conversation about raising Alaska's future today on Kids These Days. See you then.
The ideas, opinions, and commentary you hear on Kids These Days are those of the hosts, guests, and contributors and do not necessarily represent the opinions of its funders or broadcast partners. The Content Producers Guild is solely responsible for what you hear on the program. Kids These Days is made possible by a generous grant from the Association of Alaska School Boards and its Initiative for Community Engagement. Kids These Days is produced in partnership with KSKA 91.1 FM Anchorage, KRUA, and the UAA Department of Journalism and Public Communications.